Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Amplify. I'm your host, Sam Hsu, and I just want to say thank you for being a listener. Today, we've got a special treat. We are joined by the three authors of the March 2024 Pediatric Emergency Medicine Practice article on the evaluation and management of suicidal ideation and self-harm in children in the emergency department. It's a very important topic, and these three authors have done an outstanding job of summarizing it all in bite-sized nuggets that we can all digest very easily and then apply to our practice in the emergency department. But before we dive into that discussion, I want to remind you that ebmedicine.net is your one-stop shop for all of your emergency medicine and urgent care CME needs. You've got three journals that are published on a monthly basis: Emergency Medicine Practice, Pediatric Emergency Medicine Practice, and Evidence-Based Urgent Care. You have two podcasts now, Amplify and Urgentology for the urgent care crowd. You've also got the laceration course, the EKG course, and now the abscess course as well. All of that available to you at ebmedicine.net and the mobile app, which puts all of that information in the palm of your hand, and the clinical pathways that are in every single article, but also in the interactive format available for you to use on shift. So much packed into that one subscription. I highly recommend it to all of you who are listening and are not already subscribing. It is essential to your practice and there to support you in every step. And now, let's jump into that discussion about suicidal ideation and self-harm in children.
My name is Ashley Foster. I am a general emergency medicine and pediatric emergency medicine attending at the University of California, San Francisco, and an assistant professor there in emergency medicine.
Hi there, I'm Bijan Katapchi. I am a pediatric emergency medicine trained and emergency psychiatry trained physician working at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, where I am an assistant professor of pediatrics.
And I'm Jennifer Hoffman. I'm a pediatric emergency medicine physician at Ann and H. Robert Lurie Children's Hospital of Chicago and assistant professor of pediatrics at Northwestern University.
Wonderful. Thank you, all three of you, for joining us today. Now, all three of you authored the Pediatric Emergency Medicine Practice article on evaluation and management of suicidal ideation and self-harm in children in the emergency department. That was March 2024. And are joining here on the podcast to take a little bit more of a dive into the article and maybe share some of the content of the article with our listeners. It's a broad topic and certainly something we hear a little bit more about now in media than we used to, which I think is probably a good thing in most scenarios. But when it comes to learning about what the evidence-based practice is behind it and what evidence base we have for it, I found the article fascinating, really. And the most striking piece of it came across, I think, just in the introduction. So when we talk about things like suicidal ideations and self-harm in pediatrics, what do we know about the scope of this topic and how big of a problem it is for us here in the U.S.?
So I'm glad that there is more attention to this topic because now suicide is actually the second leading cause of death for children age 10 to 14 and the third leading cause of death for older adolescents and young adults 15 to 24 years old. We also know that about half of all of those youth suicide deaths occur by firearms. So that's important to consider when you're counseling families. The emergency department is really a critical contact point to detect youth who are at risk for suicide, because we know that many youth who die by suicide visit the emergency department in the months prior to their death. And it's also very important if you see a youth in the emergency department with suicidal thoughts and they're able to be discharged home. That's a pretty high-risk period right after the emergency department visit. We know that about a quarter of youth actually return to the ER within about 6 months of that visit for mental health reasons. And use of the emergency department is increasing over the last decade for mental health reasons by children, with lengths of stay increasing as well, which is often called emergency department boarding. And for all those reasons, this is a really important topic for us to cover today, Sam.
Yeah, that's a lot of numbers, but really a lot of striking numbers. None of those are small, which is a problem for us in the U.S., but especially for those of us who are working in the emergency department. I think this is becoming an increasing segment of the population that we see in the ED and something that is certainly impacting our care, but also impacting our patients. You mentioned boarding as well. That's a pretty common scenario nowadays in emergency departments across the U.S. When it comes to the etiology for suicidal ideations and self-harm, do we have data about causes and maybe how that breaks out in different segments of the population?
Yeah, you know, Sam, we actually know a lot about risk factors for suicide among youth. And I think about this in two different buckets. There are the sociodemographic factors and then the clinical factors. So in terms of sociodemographics, suicide deaths are actually more common among males, whereas suicide attempts and thoughts are higher among females. Also, among racial and ethnic groups, Alaska Native youths have the highest suicide rates, but there are important trends to know about among Black youth, where over the last decade, suicides by Black youth have been increasing over time, especially among Black adolescent females. Differences have also been found in sexual and gender minority groups. They're at higher risk for suicide attempts, and suicides are more common in rural and high poverty areas. So those are some of the demographic factors to consider, but then there are also clinical factors as well. Probably one of the most important risk factors for a suicide attempt is simply having a prior suicide attempt. And then we also know that many children who need mental health treatment in the U.S. are unable to access it. So children who are having difficulty accessing mental health treatment would be at higher risk. Some other factors include exposure to abuse, either physical abuse, sexual abuse, bullying, and access to lethal means such as firearms. But on the other side of the coin, there are also protective factors. For example, there are emerging data showing that social connectedness or feeling connected to other people, including your care team members, can really make a difference and be protective.
When we talk about emergency department treatment, I typically like to start in the pre-hospital section and in the pre-hospital care arena. For all of our colleagues who are listening to the podcast who work in the pre-hospital space, how is it that they can contribute or help when they have someone who is presenting with complaints of, say, suicidal ideations or self-harm? And what kinds of things should they be keeping in mind? Do we have data around that?
Yeah, thanks so much for that great question, Sam. So what we are understanding about pre-hospital presentation of youth with behavioral and mental symptoms is that it's quite common. And so a recent study found that up to 11% of all pre-hospital encounters by children are for behavioral health emergencies. And with this in mind, there are really limited policies and protocols that exist that can help guide pre-hospital providers right now. And this was highlighted by a recent review that found that only a couple pediatric-specific protocols existed of those that were available publicly. And so there's definitely a lot of opportunity for creation and implementation of policies and protocols that could help support pre-hospital providers in providing high-quality care to children who have mental and behavioral health emergencies. There are some unique and innovative ways that pre-hospital care can help to shape the care of children with mental and behavioral health emergencies. And one of those that's worth highlighting is the idea of an alternate destination. And so thinking about the fact that for many children who have mental and behavioral health symptoms, when they are transported from the field, they really only have the option of going to an emergency department for evaluation, assessment, and what is called medical clearance in terms of thinking about are there other medical symptoms and or emergencies that need to be immediately assessed and treated. But there is likely a very large cohort of children who wouldn't require this assessment in the emergency department setting and can bypass the emergency department and go somewhere like a crisis stabilization unit. And this can really be facilitated by special protocols that screen out youth who are at higher risk of having a medical emergency. And so one of the studies that we highlight in the article was a protocol just like this in Alameda County, where pre-hospital providers used a pre-specified set of criteria. And for youth who did not meet any of those higher risk criteria, they were sent directly to a crisis stabilization unit. And this was found to be a safe method of transport. And there were very few children who had a bounce to an emergency department within 24 hours.
That's fantastic. And that makes clinical sense. I mean, they can still be evaluated there. And if the need is still present for an emergency department visit, they can move on to that space afterwards. And I think that's fantastic. I assume that's very location specific. So you're not going to find very many places in the country that have that kind of service available. But is that a growing number of areas in the country that are moving in that direction?
I think this is a great opportunity for growth. I think that you're absolutely right, Sam, that this is very location specific right now. And we don't really know how many locations are using this alternate destination strategy, and certainly an exciting area for further study.
And then after the pre-hospital arena, when they arrive in the emergency department and we're doing our intake and our history as physicians, what kinds of things should we be asking our patients to try and pull that essential piece of history from them?
So just like any emergency department presentation, a good history is probably your best tool. When speaking with adolescents, it's really important to perform a confidential interview as part of your assessment. Studies have found that when we interview adolescents and other youth in a confidential manner, obviously discussing the limitations of confidentiality, they are more apt to relate some information regarding sensitive topics, such as suicidality. When you're discussing suicidality, one of the things we need to tease out is whether the suicidal ideation is passive versus active. Passive suicidal ideation is children who are thinking, some days I wish I wouldn't wake up. I wonder what it would be like if I was dead. Whereas active is children who actively wish they were dead or are making plans to harm themselves in a way that could be fatal. It's also very important to obtain collateral information, meaning that you speak with the parent or caregiver if they're available for discussion, to try to get some information such as, have there been any changes to the child's medication? Have there been any significant traumatic events recently? Have they noticed any weight loss or neurologic disturbances in their child? Because those are all things that we may not obtain from the history when you're interviewing the patient themselves. Other key piece is to try to obtain some information regarding the patient's other past medical history, because as many of these patients have several other health conditions they may be dealing with, such as diabetes or epilepsy. So getting a better understanding of what conditions may need ongoing monitoring while you're doing a mental health evaluation is really important.
Now, I'm curious, when it comes to the confidentiality piece, do you have a script that you use with the parent? And then how do you also then inform the patient in this scenario, the adolescent, of the problems with limitations of confidentiality based on what they disclose? Do any of you use a script of any sort in that scenario?
For me, I think I approach it in a way that's a universal thing, and it's part of our protocol for all adolescents, that we speak with them one-on-one so that they feel comfortable discussing all parts of their health with us. And when I'm speaking with the adolescents specifically, the way I approach it is I tell them everything that they tell me is between them and I, that I'm not the police, so they can discuss drug use, sexual activity, etc. The main limitations are if they have thoughts about hurting themselves or others, that I do have to notify not only my medical team, but also their caregivers.
And if they are presenting with a parent, which is often the case, and they're concerned that their parent is going to find out what is really going on with them or that anything they might disclose to you, how do you handle that with the patient?
So I provide a lot of reassurance specifically around any sort of non-suicidal activities, such as sexual activity or drug use, that those can be kept confidential as long as the substance abuse is not the means of self-harm in that scenario. I find that most adolescents that are presenting for mental health concerns, generally speaking, the parent or caregiver is oftentimes aware. And if not, the child often just hasn't found a way to broach that subject with them. And so oftentimes it's a coming together moment that is helpful for both the youth and the parent.
All right. And then one more follow-up question. Do you ever find it helpful to ask the youth if you can then go tell the parent of something that they've mentioned to you? Is it helpful to bring that up as a kind of like a permission? May I go tell your parent that you're suffering with this problem? Because I think it might help in that scenario?
Yes, I think that is a great way to approach that topic. So not only are you then allowing them to be part of the medical decision-making, which empowers them, and I just explained to them that because they're a child that, you know, whether it's getting medications or going to appointments, that having a parent being aware of their mental health conditions is going to be incredibly helpful in helping get them better.
And then for physical examination, what kinds of things are really helpful in this kind of scenario?
So with a physical exam, a very thorough physical exam, again, as with all patients, is crucial. Starting with a good set of vital signs, including temperature, can be very helpful in teasing out specific information with regards to any undisclosed self-harm attempt, such as an ingestion. So other things such as, for example, a low heart rate, bradycardia, you might be able to pick up on some subtle cues that a patient is suffering from an eating disorder, which is a common comorbidity for patients with depression or anxiety. A thorough skin exam should always be performed on these patients. You don't have to have them stripped down naked, but making sure you're evaluating wrists and legs is helpful, especially for patients that have a documented history of cutting. If there's any concern for a toxidrome, assessing a patient's tone, how rigid are they, how hyperreflexic or bradyreflexic, as well as assessing their pupillary responses can be helpful in discerning different types of toxidrome, which can help you with their management.
And in your practice, when you're assessing someone who is awake, alert, not presenting in any kind of extremis, but it screens positive for thoughts of suicidal ideations, and maybe even has a plan, and you're going to perform the physical examination, in that kind of scenario, are you stripping them of their clothing and providing them with some kind of special gown so that you can examine all of their skin, or just focusing on the areas you mentioned, like wrists and proximal thighs, areas that might be covered by clothing where they might have been cutting?
I would say that many facilities, including my own, will, after detection of suicide risk in a patient, will have them remove their articles of clothing, at least temporarily, and put on a gown. That way, we can not only examine their articles of clothing for any potentially dangerous objects, such as a razor blade or other hidden objects, but then that does give you a better ability to be able to thoroughly examine the patient's skin. And again, just normalizing it for both the patient and the parent and stating this is something that we do as a precaution for all patients that have this concern and making them not feel singled out, I think is very helpful.
Yeah, this is, I think, the part of the most inhumane thing we do to patients in the emergency department. I think in the 20 years I've practiced in the ER, that thing that has struck me the most has been our behavioral population, adults, not just children. I think because of some of those safety protocols we take, it becomes a very inhospitable, and it's always been a struggle to try and explain to someone. And it seems always to be the person who seems to be the most impacted by it just because of the nature of their presentation. Now, why we have to put them in this very specialized room and take away all of their clothing and all of their belongings. It's such a difficult scenario. And I think for me, at least, it's even more difficult when it comes to adolescents in this age population, because they're, I think, already in a place of mistrust for just about any adult that comes across them. And here I am, just one more adult now, making them even more uncomfortable by taking away their clothes and their belongings. It just seems so poorly timed and insensitive to what they're going through, but necessary. And so I'm always curious to how people script this and if there are any better ways to approach this in this population.
It is definitely one of the, I think, unfortunate circumstances that we do find ourselves in, because we obviously want to keep patients safe during their time in the emergency department, but it is not helpful and oftentimes harmful to make them feel more vulnerable and under some degree of scrutiny when they're already in a time of crisis.
Yeah.
So I'm very much in favor of protocols that we have started to implement here at CHOP and other children's hospitals around the nation, where during the course of an emergency department stay or when a patient is admitted to a psychiatric facility, there is a slow reintroduction of the patient's clothing in hopes to give them a better sense of bodily autonomy and participation in care. But it is very tough to balance the safety and the mental well-being of the patient during these times. But ultimately, our goal is to keep the patient safe. And I try to emphasize that above anything to the family and the child themselves, and that this is not a punishment by any means, but this is just part of our protocol to optimize safety for everyone.
All right. And then when it comes to screening, so most of us are doing some kind of mandated screening just by the nature of being certified by some certification body like the Joint Commission, for example. We have a number of tools out there that are available. Do we have data behind which tools are better perhaps than what we're using and how we're supposed to use those, the timing of those?
Yeah, that's a great question. So screening is really important for children presenting to the emergency department, even for those that are presenting for non-mental health related concerns. A significant proportion of those children, because of lack of access to mental health care, as Dr. Hoffman mentioned, have occult suicidality. So in fact, one review that looked at universal screening for suicide risk among youth presenting to the ED found that without this universal screening, 46 to 93% of patients with suicidality would have been missed. So that's why we emphasize this and advocate for universal screening. However, I do want to mention that there is some disagreement among governing bodies. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force guidance states that there is insufficient evidence to recommend universal suicide screening for all patients. They cite a lack of data regarding the risks and benefits with regards to the suicide screening. The Joint Commission, however, as you mentioned, requires that all patients 12 and older who are presenting to the ED for a mental health-related evaluation should be screened for suicide risk. The American Academy of Pediatrics goes a step further and recommends that all patients 12 or older, regardless of chief complaint, be screened for suicidal ideation. It also recommends that those that are 8 to 11 years old with clinical indications for suicide screening, such as those with any self-harm or those that are presenting for primary mental health chief complaints, should also be screened for suicidal ideation.
So that's three certifying bodies or three bodies writing guidelines with disagreements on if you should screen, when you should screen, and who you should screen. So the first one says they don't think there's any good evidence for the screening. The second one, the Joint Commission says if they're specifically coming for a mental health concern, then you should screen them 12 and over. And the third one says screen everyone 12 and over, and then specifically in their 8 to 11 group, if they have a mental health concern, screen them as well. Why the discrepancy, you think, between those three?
So I think the discrepancy has to do with the fact that we are in need of some more data. With regards to detection of suicide risk, there is plenty of evidence that shows that using universal screening or universal screening above certain ages is helpful and identifies a significant number of patients with occult suicidal ideation. When you also look at brief safety interventions that are performed in the emergency department or elsewhere, there is good data to show that those brief safety interventions decrease things such as repeat suicide attempts and representations to the emergency department for mental health related concerns and improve things such as linkages to outpatient mental health care. Right now, we are missing some key data that links the screening to those interventions and thus the positive outcomes that I mentioned. So as we get more longitudinal data in the future, I have no doubt that we will see some positive results here. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force mentions things such as the concern for a false positive, which in the AAP's response to the Preventive Services Task Force stance, in their rebuttal, they state that even those that have a quote-unquote false positive, there is a significant chance of a lifetime mental health disorder. And so that false positive is actually probably a great way to link that patient to care before they are in actual crisis.
So false positive, but still helpful.
Yes, incredibly okay. So.
Okay, good. And I think it's important then to draw the distinction between the screening tool, which is, you know, what everybody gets when they walk in the door, and then the subsequent assessment. So these are disagreements just about the screening tool, but if you screen positive, then you still go on and have a formal assessment, and the screening tool itself is not the actual assessment.
Correct. So there are two main validated screening tools that are most often employed through emergency departments. You have the Ask Suicide Screening Question Tool, or ASQ. and the screen version of the Columbia Suicide Severity Rating Scale, often referred to just as the Columbia. These tools are each 5 or 6 questions in length and very brief and easy to complete. The subsequent assessment that you were referring to is the BSSA, or Brief Suicide Safety Assessment. So any patients that have a positive suicide screen should go on to complete these. For the ASQ, there is the ASQ BSSA, or Brief Suicide Safety Assessment. For the Columbia, there is the Safety Assessment, which is the Suicide Assessment 5-Step Evaluation and Triage Tool. The ASQ BSSA can be found on the National Institute of Mental Health's website, whereas the Safety Tool can be found on SAMHSA's webpage.
So those are free tools available. Anyone can look up and then incorporate into their emergency department screening and assessment. And they're matched. So if you use one screen, you go on and use the other assessment for each one of these two varieties. Is that right?
That's correct. So they kind of go hand in hand. And both are equally validated and effective. There have not been any studies that compare the accuracy of the two head to head. But both of them essentially divide patients into a 3-tiered risk stratification. You have your low-risk patients who can most likely go home with some outpatient mental health follow-up. You have your high-risk patients, or your imminent risk patients, who most likely need inpatient psychiatric admission. And then you have the patients that fall into that middle tier. And that middle tier, there is an elevated risk of suicide, but you're not quite sure whether that patient requires an admission versus not. And so those patients require a full suicide safety assessment by a trained mental health professional. So if you don't have someone such as a clinical counselor, psychiatrist, or a social worker that's trained in a full suicide safety assessment for the pediatric population, those children oftentimes require a transfer to a dedicated pediatric facility.
All right. And then how do you handle the patient who's not cooperative? Not because of some medical intoxication, they just are not going to answer the questions, maybe not going to take part in the screen, or not going to comply with the follow-up questions you have to ask for the assessment tool.
I'm really glad you asked that question. So it's definitely worth noting that a lack of response to any of the screening questions or the follow-up questions and the brief safety assessment, it also is of clinical utility. So when psychiatrists evaluated patients who omitted answers to those screening questionnaires, nearly 85% of youths who omitted responses were later found to have some degree of elevated suicide risk, with almost 20% having a very high level of suicide risk.
And is that incorporated in the actual tool itself? So, for example, if you're doing the triage assessment, is there an option in there for patient is unwilling to answer? And if so, does that increase their risk rating?
It does not. Hopefully that is something that can be implemented in the future. And because I do think that is very important to note, and many people might not be aware. So okay. A lack of response is not a reassuring response.
All right. So if you're in charge of or trying to build this protocol at your own facility, maybe including an extra item in there or an educational prompt for whoever it is that's administering the assessment to say, okay, check this box if they're unwilling to answer the questions. That's a helpful piece of information.
Yeah, I would agree with that 100%.
Okay, so after we've done our screen and assessment and we're in the emergency department, we like to order things, or sometimes we don't want to order things and we're being asked to order things. So when it comes to diagnostic studies, what kinds of things are helpful for this population?
So, Sam, there's really good evidence now in this population of youth presenting for a mental health complaint that routine screening laboratory tests are not recommended because large studies have shown that they rarely change the patient's management or disposition. Just one example is a study that looked at over 1,000 children who received screening laboratory tests, and only one of the laboratory tests was not originally suspected from the patient's history and physical exam, and that was a positive pregnancy test. So in my emergency department, routine pregnancy test is the only testing that we do. There have been specific studies that looked at urine drug tests specifically and also found that those were low yield in changing management or dispositions. And the evidence in this area is strong enough that recently, the the American Academy of Pediatrics put together a Choosing Wisely campaign for pediatric emergency medicine. So this is a list of tests that are generally considered low value and that are not recommended because they increase costs without adding anything to the patient's care. And screening laboratory tests for youth who require admission to inpatient psychiatric facilities are no longer recommended on the basis of that Choosing Wisely campaign. One study estimated that if we eliminated this practice, we could save up to $90 million annually across the United States. And quality improvement efforts at individual hospitals have become successful at reducing testing. There was one such study where at their facility, they were able to reduce screening lab tests from more than 90% down to 20% of all patients. There are a few situations, however, when you should still consider laboratory tests. One is if the patient presents with a suspected intentional ingestion, you may consider labs to evaluate for toxicity or co-ingestions. And another area is when a child is presenting with acute psychosis. This is a relatively rare presentation for children to the emergency department. In many of these large studies, there were relatively few children with psychosis included, and there are more potential non-psychiatric etiologies of psychosis, you know, ranging from lupus to Wilson's disease, et cetera. So you may consider labs for that specific subset, which represents less than 3% of all children who present. And then in terms of neuroimaging, there is relatively limited data in youth, but existing data suggests obtaining it when there is concern for a structural or infectious etiology, such as if the child has a focal neurologic deficit, signs of meningitis, trauma, or headache. And then finally, if a patient comes in after an attempted hanging with a significant force or duration, such as if you see ligature marks visible on the neck, you might consider CT angiography in order to evaluate for any kind of great vessel injury, laryngeal injury, or other cervical spine injuries.
Okay, so those are going to be cases that are hopefully obvious on physical examination, but if they have a normal examination, don't give a history of ingestion, and otherwise have normal vital signs, then that would be the population that fits into this Choosing Wisely campaign who doesn't really require anything except maybe a screening pregnancy test.
Exactly, Sam.
Fantastic. Okay, and then when it comes to treatment for this population, what kinds of things should we be keeping in mind, or what should we expect and maybe tell our patients?
So the first and one of the most important pieces of treating a patient with any sort of suicide risk is managing the environment. This means making sure that clinical areas that patients are residing in are free of ligature risks, such as an otoscope cord, as well as sharp objects. And sometimes this involves even things such as wires that are in face masks. So our facility actually keeps a separate supply of purely soft face masks that do not have any sort of sharp plastic or metal within them. This also means, as we discussed earlier, making sure that patients do not have any dangerous objects on their person or in their clothes. As we discussed, one option is to have the patient change into a gown so that their clothes can be examined. The other option is that the patient can be wanded with a metal detector. Other things to consider would be for patients with diabetes, for example, making sure that any insulin pump is removed, because I'm sure many of our listeners know that a patient that overdoses on insulin can be very hard to help manage and correct. So the patient should be switched to a basal bolus schedule that the clinicians are managing themselves.
Yeah, that was a new recommendation actually I hadn't seen or thought of before. I can't remember the last time I treated a youth for a mental health emergency who was also an insulin dependent diabetic with an insulin pump, but something I don't think I've encountered very often, if at all, and something I definitely did not place in the forefront of my mind for something that has to be done. So that's a very good reminder that they can give themselves an intentional insulin bolus from the pump and then use that as a tool for a possible suicide attempt, even in the confines of the emergency department. So something I definitely did not think about.
Yes, it's definitely worth noting. And I like to mention that to all resident trainees that are coming through the emergency department, because it is unfortunately something that I have witnessed firsthand, and it can be a very scary situation.
And then what about if they're presenting on medications already for some mental illness that they're being treated for? Is there boarding in the emergency department? Is that something we continue or we stop or taper or we wait for the psychiatric evaluation first if it's going to be a long time? What do we know about that?
Another great question. So I think that discussing with the patient and their family members what medications they're currently on and or prescribed is incredibly useful. If a patient has been non-compliant with the medication, it's crucial to understand why. If they were experiencing serious adverse effects from that medication, then obviously those do not need to be restarted. And you can wait for psychiatry's input on how to best manage those medications. However, patients can also experience discontinuation syndromes with many psychotropic medications. So in order to avoid those, it's really important to restart home medications, even if a patient has missed a few doses, because reinitiating those meds is not going to precipitate a catastrophic event. So even though a lot of us as emergency physicians feel less well-versed in psychiatric medications in general, these medications are generally very safe, and barring any serious adverse events, restarting those is most advantageous for the patient.
Okay, so even while they're still in the emergency department?
I would say definitely while they're in the emergency department, especially if they are going to be there for a prolonged period of time. For many facilities, it takes a long time to get in contact with a child psychiatrist or have someone that is able to provide further recommendations. So for children that are staying there a day or longer, you really don't want to be missing any doses of their home medicines.
And then for the youth who is engaged in self-harm, maybe they're cutting and now we have some wounds that might need repair, it's okay to undergo that wound repair in the emergency department and treat that as we normally would for any other wound infection or wound repair. Is that right?
Exactly. So I would say the main thing for children, and as you do with adults, is making sure they are up to date on their tetanus vaccines, but it is okay to repair those as you would otherwise. And rather than going into management of specific ingestions and toxidromes, I'll refer the listeners to the December 2023 pediatric emergency medicine practice that discusses that specifically.
Fantastic. Yes, there's a discussion in the article there about things like acetaminophen overdose, salicylate overdose, and other toxic ingestions. But you're absolutely right. There is a deep dive on that for the December article. So if that's something you're interested in reading as well, I'd recommend both this article and that as a resource. Now, there are some special populations, some maybe particularly challenging populations of patients who might present in this scenario. Well, let's start with children with intellectual disabilities or autism spectrum disorder. How should we handle that differently in that scenario?
Right. So this is a group of children who really has a lot of unique needs and considerations. And more often, they can present with different types of self-injurious behaviors, such as headbanging or self-biting, but can also present with unsafe behaviors towards others as well. And in these children, it's important to ask if their presenting behaviors are baseline or if they've changed at all from their baseline. Because children who have more limited communication abilities, in these children, these behaviors may represent a manifestation of pain in some cases from a medical etiology. For example, I've seen children come in with an ear infection, dental infection, constipation, or UTI. And these medical conditions actually provoked increased behaviors of self-harm or harm towards others. So it's important to do a very thorough review of systems and physical exam in this population. Now, if it does turn out that these behaviors are more psychiatric in etiology and require inpatient level of care, these children often require more specialized services. And so due to limitations in the facilities able to accept these patients, they are unfortunately at increased risk of boarding in the emergency department for prolonged durations. And this is not an environment that's set up well to meet these children's needs. There can be sensory overstimulation, kind of a lack of routines. And so as much as possible, trying to modify the environment to make it a bit more tolerable is helpful. Some examples could be reducing sensory stimulation by, you know, dimming the lights, reducing noise, putting them in a quieter corner of the emergency department, making sure that consistent staff members are coming in as much as possible, Providing Safe Activities for Calming and Distraction. A really neat resource compiled by my colleagues is the New England Regional Behavioral Toolkit, which provides guides for purchasing specific low-cost activities that can be provided to these children, as well as a number of different resources on ensuring that children are meeting their activities of daily living and maintaining safety while they're boarding. So it's a great resource to check out. And there's also a prior article in Pediatric Emergency Medicine Practice from January 2018 called Best Practices in Managing Child and Adolescent Behavioral Health Emergencies that goes into more detail about managing and preventing acute agitation and aggression among these children.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Again, this is an environment that is pretty terrible, loud, bright, filled with stimulation, and often with things that we're going to do to them that's very uncomfortable. So in this patient population, I can imagine that is particularly distressing. So more things to keep in your bag of tricks when it comes to trying to help with this patient population. There was a mention in the article of the no suicide contract, or the contract for safety, as we used to call it back in a decade ago or so. This is something that is now going by the wayside as a practice. Is that right?
Yes, Sam. So this is no longer recommended. And this, just to give a little bit of context for those who may not have had prior experience, the no suicide contract was this idea that a physician or provider and a patient would make an agreement or contract that the patient would abstain from self-harm and would reach out to a medical professional in experiencing crisis. And there's really no high quality evidence to support this practice, and some medical legal concerns given this term contract and what that might imply. And so really the recommendation is to use evidence-based tools, things like safety planning. And we've given an example of a safety planning tool, the Stanley Brown safety plan, in the article. And so using tools like that, which are evidence-based instead of the no suicide contract, which is not evidence-based.
And then there was also a little discussion about whether or not suicide screening increases the risk of suicide. You know, does just posing the question then plant a seed in someone's mind? Is that actually real?
This is certainly an ongoing concern, I think, both by providers and sometimes caregivers. And what we understand of the data through a pretty impressive systematic review that included 17 studies for review and 8 studies for analysis. The studies looked at patients who were asked about suicide and self-harm compared to those who were not, and really showed that asking about these topics did not change the risk for subsequent suicide-related behaviors, self-injury, or psychologic distress. And so it's really felt that asking the question does not put a child or youth at increased risk of then developing these thoughts and behaviors. Certainly a limitation that we mentioned in the article is that these studies were not conducted in the ED setting, but given the broad and large group of studies that are included, we feel it's really applicable to the emergency department as well.
And then the very last step in the Stanley Brown safety plan is making an environment safer. So before we're sending someone home after they've been screened and treated, we want to make sure they're going home to a safe environment. And the language here used is lethal means counseling. What exactly does that encompass?
Yeah, thank you, Sam. So lethal means counseling is one of the most important things, especially for patients that you are discharging home. So lethal means counseling simply means discussing any dangerous items in the home that could potentially result in serious injury or harm, and making a specific plan for how to keep your child safe at home. So the way that we approach this, and we did include some sample verbiage in our piece that I'll cover, is to introduce the topic, explain the importance, and then provide some guidance on safety at home. So the way we often go about this is by simply telling parents that many children and teens are struggling with mental health, and that when we identify that risk, we like to provide families with some information on how to keep their children safe at home. So even for children that we think may not be struggling with mental health, unfortunately, over the last year, 1 in 5 adolescents has seriously considered suicide. So it's much more prevalent than most people realize. Suicide is, in fact, now the second leading cause of death in adolescents. And children are very impulsive, with over 70% moving from considering suicide to acting on suicide in less than 1 hour.
Wow.
And so the best way to keep your family safe at home is to reduce access to those things. And that's what lethal means safety planning is. The way I phrase it is, we most commonly discuss medications, which are the most common means of suicide attempt, and firearms, which are the most lethal means of suicide attempt. So we recommend removing any of those dangerous items from the home during the crisis that the child is experiencing, even if that's just temporarily. Or if you can't remove them from the home, securing them in a locking cabinet, a lockbox, or with a locking device of some sort that the child does not have access to. By doing some of these steps, you can actually reduce the risk of suicide by almost 80%. And providing those key stats to the parent oftentimes, you know, turns on a light bulb in their head and just is like, wow, that's a striking number. And yeah. I find that most parents are very willing to make those changes at home.
And the medications, this is not just medications that are specific to the patient, but medications that the parent might have, or if there's a grandparent in the house, or, you know, wherever the medicine cabinet is, all of those things that might be lethal if overdose ingested.
Correct. And I always like to emphasize with parents that it is not just prescription medications that can be dangerous, that over-the-counter medications can be very dangerous as well, as many of us know. But I think that is a common misconception among caregivers. And especially for children that split their time, for parents that are separated, or if a child spends a lot of their time with their grandparents, it's important that we tell families to reach out to those other family members so that they can inform them of those safety planning lessons as well.
Perfect. There is a section in the article about some novel methods for identifying suicide risk. I mean, using natural language processing, AI is on everybody's mind nowadays. That's something that we can incorporate into our practice in the ED when we're screening for suicide.
I think this is a really exciting and certainly hot topic of conversation. The natural language processing is an innovative way to screen and identify patients at risk. I think it's an emerging area where there is more evidence, and really exciting. And even in the past, I think, month, another article was published pertaining to the computerized adaptive testing, and specifically a model called CASI. And so this computerized adaptive testing is utilized to assess, estimate, and predict future suicide behavior. And how this specific tool works is it has 72 items, but adapts as the user is answering questions. And so really is able to more individualize risk compared to broad screening tools where the same questions are asked to all individuals. And the data is really exciting in its comparison to things like screening tools like ASQ, that it performs really well. And it only takes a couple minutes to take for the child or youth, 1 to 2 minutes. A limitation is that the studies thus far that have been conducted have been in academic medical centers. And so certainly there is room and space to see how this performs in all emergency department settings, but it's definitely a really exciting tool that's on the horizon.
And that computer adaptive testing is something that you could run on a tablet or something and hand to the patient as a tool to take, like, here, please answer these questions kind of thing.
Exactly, Sam. That's exactly how it can be used.
Perfect. Okay, and then the ultimate question in the end is, when we've identified, examined, and treated someone, and then we're trying to determine disposition, and we're talking about level of care and where they're going to go, is there anything that can help guide us in that decision-making as emergency physicians, and perhaps with someone who's been boarding for a significantly long period of time?
So I think when you're trying to make that ultimate determination on disposition, the brief safety assessments that we mentioned earlier that are related to the ASQ and the Columbia can be very helpful in stratifying a patient's level of risk. So if you are determine that a patient is falling into that lower risk category, I would definitely recommend going through the Stanley Brown safety planning intervention, including the lethal means counseling. Patients that fall into that medium and high risk category will likely ultimately need either a full evaluation from a trained pediatric psychiatry team and or inpatient psychiatric admission. So certainly, I think it is important to develop partnerships between areas that do have psychiatric care and those that don't, so that you can consult your local child psychiatrist in an on-call manner, or even implementing things such as telepsychiatry.
Yeah, I think as our listeners have probably heard me say a million times on the podcast, you don't want to be figuring this out at 2 a.m. on a Saturday morning in the middle of a busy emergency department shift. You should have some kind of protocol for transfers if you don't have the psychiatric services available at your facility. But someone who is low risk, so I think is the most likely person who I'm going to be charged with disposition for. In that scenario, is it best practice for me to say, you know, you're low risk, here are some resources you can follow up with as an outpatient? Or is it supposed to be, you're low risk and I've called and this is the person you're going to see tomorrow at 8 a.m. Now you may go home.
I would say that I would definitely prefer the latter. And I think that you would be doing the right thing for the patient and the family by doing that as well. So if possible, within your institution to make referrals to a child psychiatry team, and any sort of aid that you can provide in facilitating follow-up for that child will be incredibly helpful. Even if that is just providing a phone call to the child's primary care physician, their primary care physician can then help quarterback the child's care in case that you are not able to provide some of the referrals that they need. Several hospitals have actually implemented caring contacts in various forms where after a discharge from the emergency department, they will send reminders for future appointments or a touch base, a questionnaire of sorts where they can ask how the patient is doing in order to facilitate follow-up and provide reassurance.
Excellent. Well, there is a very good clinical pathway on page 17 of this article. Who wrote this clinical pathway for us?
So yes, this was actually developed in conjunction with the National Institute of Mental Health. So this pathway, I think, is incredibly useful, especially for those that are less well-versed in the mental health arena. And I think it can provide a great framework, even if you don't follow it to a T.
Yeah, I love clinical pathways just because they help, you know, simplify very complex topics into something that I can follow easily during a busy shift. And so I like this one specifically because it references some of the screening tools, the follow-up assessment, who needs to go to the assessment, who doesn't, and who becomes what they call an imminent risk or high risk, and who is low risk, and it has it all spelled out there. So if you have access to the article, I highly recommend it. If you don't have access to the article, this is a free reference from the NIH that's listed online. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. This is a free reference, and it's incredibly helpful. Many institutions have implemented this type of pathway into their emergency department, so it can be more protocolized. And in fact, one hospital implemented a protocolized use of this and had some of those suicide screening questions implemented within the EMR and then had that follow up with the recommended next steps. Not only did they improve their suicide screening from 0% to 94%, but it actually decreased length of stay in the emergency department because they had that well-oiled machine of the protocol.
Excellent. That is fantastic news. So if you're listening, you heard him say decreased length of stay, right? A key metric we care about in the emergency department, and it improved care. I mean, you rarely see things that do both of those things at the same time. So I'll include a link to that. That's the Ask Suicide Screening Questions Toolkit, which includes that clinical pathway. I'll put a link to that in the show notes for all of our listeners who don't have access to the article.
Another resource you can provide to families if you're able to discharge them home is the National 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline, which was established relatively recently. And instead of dialing 911, you can direct them to dial 988 in a crisis. It's 24/7 free access to counselors. And for adolescents, there's also an accompanying text line as well.
Excellent. Well, thank you to all three of you for being on the podcast and especially for being authors of the article. I found it to be an outstanding reference and something I'm definitely going to keep in my pocket. And if you're listening, like I said, you have access to it, I highly recommend you go read it, get your CME, and keep this article in your back pocket for your next shift in the emergency department. And I look forward to reading more from the next article that you three author. I'm sure after spending all your time doing this, you're ready for a break, but it was very well written. Thank you very much for being on the podcast and for being authors.
Thank you, Sam.
Thank you so much for having us, Sam.
Well, that's a wrap, everyone. Thank you for joining us once again for this special episode of the podcast. I sincerely hope it is informing you and assisting you in your practice like it has done to mine. Before you go, I want to remind you about ebmedicine.net, the three journals, the interactive pathways, the mobile app, the laceration course, the EKG course, the abscess course, and so much more at ebmedicine.net. Go there today, subscribe if you're not already a subscriber, and claim your CME for listening to this podcast and reading the article. Until next time, everyone, be safe.